Thank you for listening to this Podcast One Sportsnet production, available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
The following program is a PodcastOne.com production.
He started in a small town in Texas. Worked his ass off to become one of the most famous wrestlers of all time.
We're going to take care of business tonight, and that's the bottom line.
And now, he's dominating the world of on-demand audio.
And he's doing it for the working man.
This is a damn good outlet for me to spew the bullshit off my brain.
Yeah!
This is the Steve Austin Show. Unleashed.
All right, everybody, welcome to Steve Austin Show. I'm coming to you from the mean streets of Los Angeles, California today. I'm sitting here in my office at 316 Gimmick Street. God damn, what a day it has been. Holy shit. Man, I tell you what, I jumped out of bed this morning. Strike that. I didn't jump out of bed. I rolled out of bed, put on my right flip-flop, went to put on my left flip-flop, and there it was. Gone. Moolah had hijacked it. So I walked into the kitchen with my one flip-flop footed ass and started making my eggs and my oatmeal, cooking my breakfast. No coffee, sleepy as a motherfucker, tossed and turned all night. Sat down and ate my breakfast. Moolah brought me my other flip-flop. Now I was balanced out and had breakfast. And that's when I remembered. Oh, shit, Steve. Your wife made you an appointment with the dentist. I had to go to the dentist and get my teeth cleaned. Motherfucker. My wife has been on my ass to get my teeth cleaned for about the last couple years. I think I recorded on the podcast a couple years ago one of my trips, and it was brutal. And she'd been trying to make me a bunch of appointments, and I kept putting her off and putting her off and putting her off. And finally, I said, you know what? I better go get my fucking teeth cleaned and listen to my wife. So she booked the appointment. And it was time to go pay the piper. So, took a shower, shaved up all nice. I was scruffy. Hell, I hadn't shaved in about 6 days. I had a pretty good beard going on. My wife didn't like it. It ain't hunting season yet. So I shaved, got all spiffed up, and headed down to the dentist. Rolled in there, right on time, laid back in that chair for a teeth cleaning session. Holy shit. The lady that was cleaning my teeth, she put on her mask. She put on her rubber gloves. And she grabs this tool. It's got a big hook on the end of it with a big scraper. And it vibrates at a high frequency. Looks like a Dremel bit, but sharper and more elegant. And she went to work doing precision work, cleaning all the plaque and yellow bullshit off my damn teeth, built up from over 2.5 years of not getting my teeth cleaned at the dentist. I should have listened to my wife 2.5 years ago. I was sitting in that goddamn chair with my mouth wide open. I got that little hook in there, that suction hook. It sucks all the shit out of your mouth, the saliva and the blood. And that lady, she got that damn high-frequency vibration thing just chipping in on my damn teeth, pulling that plaque off. And I could feel that ridge. I could feel that point go over that ridge. I knew that's what she was trying to grind down. I was like, oh, fuck, I'm going to be here a while. And all I could think about was the last time that I was getting something done at the doctor was my damn car getting towed off because I parked at the damn parking meter, and I got towed off. Y'all done heard that story. So I'm sitting there thinking the same fucking thing. I'm on Wilshire Boulevard in Santa Monica, and I put 2 hours in that machine because I calculated there's no way. There's no way it can take 2 hours to clean all the shit off my teeth. Anyway, it didn't take 2 hours because I had a one-hour appointment. They had to get to somebody else. So the whole time I'm thinking, I got to be out there before my car gets towed off or I get a ticket because that's going to be a $52 ticket that I don't want to pay. The teeth cleaning session lasted about 55 minutes. And bless that lady's heart that was cleaning my teeth. She wore glasses and she had that germ thing across her face. And you know, there's so much shit. I was thinking, you know, like there's almost like that damn movie where that guy was flossing his teeth and all these chunks are hitting the goddamn mirror. I was just thinking pieces of damn chicken and beef and fish and broccoli was going to get on this lady's glasses and she's going to need windshield wipers to get those motherfuckers off there so she could see what she's doing. And she kept working and she was really gentle and my gums were bleeding like a motherfucker. And then I was like Jesse Ventura in Predator. I ain't got time to bleed. And there I laid, bleeding with that suction thing, sucking all the goddamn blood out of my mouth. And I'm thinking, dude, you should have listened to your fucking wife. Those 2.5 years she kept telling you, go get your teeth clean, go get your teeth clean, go get your teeth clean. I said, no, they're all right, I'm brushing them. I use my dental floss. Hey, man, here's a heads up from yours truly, Steve Austin, the owner of the Steve Austin Show podcast. If you're a guy and you're driving down a truck because that's what you do, go get your teeth clean. If you're down in a coal mine, you're out there picking that coal out there, doing what you do, heavy, badass work, go get your teeth clean. If you're an insurance man or a teacher or a plumber or an electrician, I don't give a fuck what you are. Do your due diligence. Take your ass down to your dentist on your dental plan. Hopefully you got some insurance. And go get your teeth cleaned, because you don't want to put yourself in a position I put myself in. I had so much shit on my teeth. By the time that lady got done, she goes, I did the best I could, but we're going to need to see you again in about 2 weeks so we can finish the job. And here's the thing. When she was working on my teeth and I was laying back in that chair with my mouth wide open like an idiot, drooling, and that thing sucking all that spit and blood out of my mouth, she was using that damn bit. During the middle of the process, not even the middle, it was about 3/4 done. While she was working on my damn mouth, she rolled over to the damn cabinet and removed the tip that she was using to work on my teeth. And I'm thinking, okay, is she going to put on a different tool? No, she put on the same kind of gimmick scraper with a curve and a sharp thing on the end of it. I had worn out the first fucking Dremel bit because I had so much plaque and bullshit built up on my teeth. So don't put yourself in a position that I put myself in. The thing about it is, that's oral, you know, the mouth, that's oral, oral surgeon, oral dentist. That's your oral cavity. You get so much germs built up in your damn mouth, it can fuck with your whole system. Anyway, I'm going back for my follow-up session, and you got to keep your damn mouth clean. You know, I brush my teeth. I floss my teeth. I think I got pretty good hygiene. But take your ass to the dentist and get your shit cleaned by a professional. You'll thank me once you do it, and you will be amazed at the difference you will see and feel. Anyway, enough about all that bullshit, man. I tell you what, my guest today is Rob Van Dam, the whole effing show down there in ECW. Guy who had a hell of a damn run, really nice guy. He came by the crib last Saturday, and we spent 2 hours talking during prime college football watching hours. And you're going to hear the first part of that conversation today, and we're going to roll the second part next Thursday. But it was good sitting down and talking to Rob Van Dam, because I remember wrestling Rob. I think it was a Monday Night Raw TV one time. I was burned out, and I wasn't in a good space, and we had an okay match. And me and Rob, we never hung around together in the hotels and just in general. So this conversation, like I told him, I said, man, you know, as many times as I've crossed by Rob, and we always say hello to each other in the airport because it's always good to see one of the boys. I said, man, it's the first time I've ever really sat down and talked to you. So we had a great conversation. It was good talking to Rob. And he's got a bunch of cool stories about how he came up and paid his dues and down there training with the Sheik and his ties and his relationship with Sabu and all kinds of great stories. It was really cool to talk to Rob Van Dam for such a long time. And he's a very interesting guy and had a hellacious run. And at the end of the podcast, I've got a badass match for you to watch with Rob in it to see him in action down in ECW. But before we get to Rob Van Dam, the whole effing show, let me tell you how you can get your hands on some pretty exclusive WWE merchandise. Sign up for Loot Crate's new WWE Slam Crate. It's a bi-monthly mystery subscription service for fans of the WWE Universe. And the first Loot Crate in the series is the Founders Theme, which celebrates some of the greatest firsts in WWE history. Here's what I can tell you about it. It's got the first card from Austin Aries, and a few of the Loot Crates will have autographed versions of that card. You'll also get a shirt back from the grave and accessories from a very special First Lady of Wrestling. This is an exclusive Superstar Collectibles line created just for the WWE Slam Crate. You can't get this stuff anywhere else, people. The WWE Slam Crate is delivered every 2 months, and for less than $30, you get over $60 in merchandise in every crate. I'm talking licensed gear, apparel, collectibles, unique one-of-a-kind items, and a lot more. And if you go to lootcrate.com/unleashed and use the promo code unleashed, you can save $3 off any new subscription. That's lootcrate.com/unleashed and use the promo code unleashed to save $3 off any new subscription. But you got to get your order in by 9 p.m. Pacific Standard Time on the 19th or you'll miss out, because once these crates are gone, they are gone. So get your WWE Slam Crate order in by 9 p.m. Pacific Standard Time on the 19th. And remember, use the promo code UNLEASHED to save $3 off any new subscription.
Welcome to Two Shorts Boombox, where every week it's a party in my studio. Me and all my interesting friends having dope conversations. And now my fans get to join in. Every episode is a lot of fun, baby. We dropping game for everybody, from the hip-hop heads to the entrepreneurs. And check out the new Two Short exclusives, unheard music, from me and all my boombox artists. You don't want to miss an episode. Wednesdays, Two Shorts Boombox. Download it now on the Podcast One app, iTunes, or at podcastone.com.
I'm rolling sound right now. I'm sitting here with RVD at 316 Gimmick Street. We just got finished talking telephone technology with the smartphone. These smartphones are smarter than I am. Hey, Rob, I know you have a tendency to cuss a little bit, as do I.
Yes.
So I thought we'd roll unleashed here, but, you know, if you want to keep it family-friendly, we can do that, too. You have option A of going unleashed. You got option B of going family-friendly.
Feel free to talk uncensored and candidly.
Hey, well, speaking of just talking in four-letter words, and all I've read about you, and man, we've known each other for a long time, but it's not like we never traveled together.
No, we really don't know each other.
No.
I know your character way more than I know you, and I don't know if you're different than your character or not, and I would assume you probably feel
way
the same
different
about me.
I'm not walking around here crashing beer cans up and getting on a corner and saying, give me a hell yeah.
Right.
Kristen, my wife, if you'll cook me a TV dinner, give me a hell yeah. Nah.
No.
I'm actually a little bit more laid back than I was. I always like this thing, and probably maybe you're the same. You know, Stone Cold was Steve Austin turned up to 11, and then I just turned him down because I was being who and what I was.
Yeah.
But, I mean, certainly I don't. Dude, the last few times we passed each other was in airports.
Yeah.
A couple of years ago.
Right.
And so, I mean, I'm low-key. I've read that you're a loner. Same here. I love people. But, man, if I don't see nobody for a long time, I'm fine with that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, and it's a lot to do with energies, you know, from everything is energy for me. Like, that's the way I see the entire world.
Has it been like that ever since you grew up? Because in a lot of your, I watched a lot of your interviews, and you always talk about positive energy and vibrations.
Yeah, it's always, I would say I wasn't aware of it until, like, I started getting into martial arts as a teenager and started, like, meditating and started having some of this taught to me. But as an adult, it definitely became a higher priority, and the more recent years, it's more and more important for me to try to better myself spiritually, and that's something that I hope to always do. If you ask, what's important, what am I doing right now? I'm just trying to be a better person every day, and I know that I am, because every time I look back, whether I'm looking back a week or several years, I always look back at the flaws and try to fix them. Like, that's part of, I don't know if it's a self-perfectionist in me or what, but if I look way back to, like, the me that, like, the ECW guys knew and stuff, and I think of, like, 96, 97 RVD, I think that kid was an asshole. Really.
Yeah.
I was cocky. Yeah, my values were different.
But your values are different. But there comes a point in your career where you do get cocky, if not overconfident. Because if you're not confident, because I watched a lot of your stuff when you were hot, when you were the whole fucking show in ECW, and you had the swagger and everything that goes with it. I mean, you were having a heavy push. You were pretty much the feature of the organization. I mean, if you don't believe in yourself, I mean, it kind of was, it was a parallel to a lot of guys. But Sean was kind of like that as well. You guys are completely different animals. But, dude, if you're the – you got in show business, or you got into the wrestling business, and, pretty much a direct quote from you is, hey, man, your whole thought process on going out there to work was show off.
Yeah, and that's all I've really enjoyed about it. I never really enjoyed trying to deliver someone else's message. And there's a certain amount of acting to it. Obviously, if I do a promo – and to be the best professional wrestler, you have to be good at delivering someone else's message. But, that RVD that they are living through, they meaning The Office, well, that's my brand. That's what I live off of. So it's not the same as just acting. Like, my personal values, I can tell you that this next Monday when I'm in whatever fucking Poughkeepsie, that the TV title championship match means more than anything to me. But fuck no, it doesn't.
Yeah.
I don't give a fuck about that. I have way different values. And the more I came in touch with that in recent years, the less passion or ambition I have for wrestling. Because that is part of it. I mean, back in ECW, let me just explain.
Yeah.
So back in ECW, when you're talking about when I was on top of that company, I was at a point where I think a lot of people like yourself, to be the top guy and to be able to deliver those promos where you really think that you're saying, I am the best, there ain't anyone that can touch me. I think you have to, like you say, believe in yourself, but also you got to be a little bit crazy to really believe that you are the fucking best.
It's a shoot. I mean, it's a shoot mindset.
Yeah.
I mean, the business is a work. We know that, but man, you hit it right on the head. When I'm out there, if I'm saying something, I might be doing somebody else's storyline or giving a storyline that I am in, but I believe it hook, line, and sinker while I'm there. Now, when I get in my rental car and I'm driving off, I'm thinking, hey, man, that's pretty good. You know, we did a good job pulling that angle off. But right there in the moment or just in a match, yeah, I'm working. Some of my shit's a little snug, as it was yours or is. But I believe what I'm doing. You can compare it exactly to a UFC fight. You know, it might be called, it might be scripted, it might be set up, might know the finish. But other than that, man, the act of doing it, it'd be just like a Daniel Day-Lewis, one of these badass actors, delving into a part, which I would never wear the shit as an actor. But as a wrestler, I didn't pretend to be a wrestler. I was a wrestler.
Right. And so for me, like, when I'm in the ring showing off, I totally believe, like, every moment, I think that's part of what makes my work stand out to certain people, the way I sell, whatever, because I'm totally into it. But I would say back in the day, I really did carry around that ego that, like, fuck yeah, man, I'm the whole effing show, I'm the best. And I had the freedom to back it up every single night. I was like, what's important to me is that this whole company grows with all my efforts. It's on my shoulders. I want everyone that bought a ticket tonight in our biggest house ever, because back then I was watching it grow, I want everyone to be happy that they bought a ticket to see me. So I'm going to work my balls off and do the best I can. And afterward, when they're all screaming, oh, fucking show, and they all have signs, it was rewarding. And I think that kind of belief, like feeding into that, that's, you got to have that drive, because although you may say it's a work, there really is a lot of competition that's so easy for people that are on the outside to never know about. And back then, you know, I had that competitive edge where I wanted to stand out more than the next guy, more than the guy that I'm working with. I want the people, the promoters, everyone to be talking about me, and that's the competition. And I don't have that. I don't want to fight to, you know, to go out there and tell the story anymore. And these kids that do want to fight, they don't even know what the right things to fight for.
But part of that reality that bleeds into the work is the fact that you're fighting to keep your spot, because every single time you go out there, I mean, go back to your television title reign was what, going on 2 years or over?
Yeah.
And so every week you're going out there to, you're putting it on the line. You're the whole effing show. So if somebody starts blowing your shit out of the water every week, well, you're not so much the whole fucking show. And the point I'm going to here is we're going to leapfrog into all the other territories real quick, and then we'll come back. But you had so much creative freedom in ECW towards the end, and CM Punk, before he left, and I consider CM Punk a friend of mine, but he felt creatively stifled, and I believe that he was. And at points in my career, I felt that way in WWF as well. After you left ECW, wherever you went, did you ever have that freedom again, or did you ever feel whole? Because at ECW, you could do whatever the fuck you wanted.
Well, I mean, there's not that many places to go, and there's not that many territories. So if you're talking about doing one-off indie shots or whatever, of course I can, you know.
Yeah, but WWE, you run there, so, TNA.
Yeah, so with WWE, I mean, I felt like when I went there, there was nothing else left, right?
Right.
And I hadn't gone anywhere between ECW and WWE. I hadn't. Some indie shots, very few. I do them very selectively. And, you know, I did a movie, whatever. But when I went there, I looked at it at that time as artistically selling out because of my perception of what WWE was.
What was your perception of what WWE was?
It seemed like the Disneyfied version of wrestling. Because here we were in ECW. Nobody ever asked us, do you guys ever really hit each other? Because we beat the fuck out of each other. I mean, when I do these concussion interviews and people ask how many concussions I've had, I think about Balls Mahoney every single night whacking me with that chair. The sound going out, everything's in slow motion, and I didn't know that could lead to long-term damage, obviously, but the style was something that we were all so proud of that we wanted to see ECW take off, and we wanted to just connect with the like-minded fans that appreciated the difference. And, you know, once that folded, because I sacrificed a lot of, you know, and I gave up offers and turned away to stay there. And once that went down, and there was no other option if I wanted to continue being a professional wrestler on TV in the United States, WWE was all there was. Paul was already there. So when I was ready and made the call, I did look at it like, okay, basically, I'm doing this for the business, for the money, not for the art, because they're probably going to call me Robot Van Damme and have me like go out there, like, you know, they're going to recreate my character, erase my past, because that is what I thought about them. Right. And plus, while we were beating the shit out of each other, I would see the WWE guys like tap each other in the back with a chair and go down, and it was insulting to me, and it was insulting what, you know, just what I was hearing them say, because they started like exposing more of, you know, the entertainment side. And I'm being trained by the original Sheik, I have those old school values that I still can't compromise, and I kind of feel like, why should I now? I'm on my way out now. I'm not really trying to do much, you know what I mean? So yeah. It's hard for me to think about changing my values of really believing that, you know, that it's about beating the guy and trying to win the match. And
did you think at any point now, looking back, that in ECW, I stopped in there for a cup of coffee. Paulie gave me a call. My arm was busted. I got a chance to cut promos. He taught me how to cut promos. There was tremendous promos being caught, badass matches that were going on, great character development, and I got some freedom to go out on a limb. So I just enjoyed my short stay there. I wasn't part of the crux or the hard work that all you guys laid down the blood, tears, and sweat and sacrifice for. But my question is, now that you look back, with the violence level being as high as it was on a night-in, night-out basis, wherever you guys were working, how often you guys were working, specifically television tapings or pay-per-views, at some point do you think collectively the boys started out working each other, just going overboard with the violence?
Like, we all kind of had our own niches,
yeah,
right? And so, like, right when I got there, and, you know, Sabu was, he was my mentor,
yes,
already. So I believed anything that he said. At that point in my career, you know, if he said, hey, you know, go slap that guy or whatever, you know, all right, I don't know, I would just do whatever he said. And I got in the dressing room for the first time, he said, those guys are the shits. So that was fact to me. It was just like, okay, you know, fuck those guys. And and then we would watch the different styles, and like Sabu and I, we already were doing those kind of matches. We had been for, that's what we did with the tails and flying out and all that. So we would do that, and the crowd was really reacting, and then the crowd liked everybody for different reasons, but my ego, you know, didn't have that same appreciation, you know. So I was like, oh, that guy can't wrestle, or that guy needs to bring weapons in, or that guy needs to bleed every night because he can't work. And and that's kind of how I saw it all back then. But obviously the fans loved it, so, you know, I now looking back, I can't deny that, and I know that we were a family, even if at the time, you know, like I said, I kind of think I was a bit of an asshole.
I think ECW, it was very special, and it certainly made a lasting impact in the history of the business. I was glad I stopped through there. But do you think ECW would have worked had it been based out of Los Angeles or Kansas City, Missouri? Was there something special about Philly and the fucking ECW, that shithole, the bingo hall? I mean, with respect, when I talk about buildings, I mean it with respect.
There was. No, there's no question in my mind about it. Like, that part of the country, their culture is so different. And, you know, when you get to travel, you see how different people are from the Northeast and, like, say, down in the South, you know, or West.
Yeah.
When ECW started to travel with their shows, we found those same people and brought them out of the woodworks in every state. And it was amazing to see. But then again, those fans were actually imitating the fans that they saw on TV from the Northeast. But just to explain the difference in their culture, the first time that I took my wife to Philly, we were at the diner, the Philadelphia diner there on Oregon, where we used to go to, and we were just getting food at night, and the waitress, you know, she comes over and she just looks at her and she's like, "You know what you want?" And my wife was looking like, "Gee," and she "Okay, I'll take this and shorter," and she's like, "You want sugar? You know, or you want steak sauce?" Whatever she was like, "You? All right." And she just walked away. And my wife goes, "Is it just me or is that lady a bitch?" And I said, "No, but everyone is like that here. That's the way that they are. They're rude to each other and they expect it and they don't mean anything by it."
Yeah. All right, Rob, I want to talk about your formative years. Go back to high school and when you started your martial arts training. But before we do that, I need to give a quick word of thanks to all the sponsors of the Steve Austin Show and to you guys for supporting all the sponsors. And that, of course, includes the one that could win you some serious instant cash, DraftKings.com, the destination for one-week fantasy football. Here's why you should be playing fantasy football at DraftKings. You ain't got to worry about bench warmers like Tom Brady taking up room on your roster while you wait for him to serve his suspension. And you ain't got to worry about busts like the Rams running back Todd Gurley or Eddie Lacy on the Packers. Neither have generated many touchdowns or even rushing yards, and that means they're not generating points for your fantasy team. At DraftKings, you're not stuck with the same lineup week after week. You can draft a different quarterback, receiver, running back, and tight end every time you play. You won't be up at 2 a.m. in the morning trolling the waiver wire looking for someone to replace your latest injured player. At DraftKings.com, you're never out of the money, and if you use my promo code UNLEASHED, you can play for free with your first deposit. And this is a good weekend to do it because DraftKings is hosting another huge fantasy contest with over $1 million in total prizes up for grabs. So get to DraftKings.com now and choose your players for this weekend's contest. And if you use my promo code UNLEASHED, you can play for free with your first deposit. That's promo code UNLEASHED to play for free for your share of over $1 million in total prizes this weekend. Only at DraftKings.com. Eligibility restrictions may apply. See website for details. We've all taken jobs to earn some extra cash, and if that's the position you're in now, there's an easier way to do that, thanks to Uber. Uber's the ultimate side hustle. It's not just another J-O-B. It's a totally flexible way to earn. You can turn it on and off just like your car. If you have a few spare hours here and there, drive with Uber. If you're driving right now, you should be earning right now. So do it. Every day is payday when you drive with Uber because you cash out whenever you want with Instant Pay. Instant Pay lets you cash out your earnings up to 5 times a day with no minimum amount required. And who doesn't want to be their own boss? That's what Uber lets you do. So if you need some extra cash, if there's something special you'd like to buy, if you need flexibility in your schedule, if you just want to be your own boss, sign up to drive with Uber today. Go ahead. Get your side hustle on. Sign on to drive with Uber. Go to uber.com/drive now. That's uber.com/drive now. One more time, uber.com/drive now.
Steve Austin, Unleashed.
Unleashed.
Hey, let's go back a second to your developmental days. Well, I was going to talk about being trained by the Sheik, Ed Farhat. But let's go back to your formative years in either junior high or high school. I know you started taking martial arts, taekwondo, stuff like that. But when I watch you work, you seem like just a well-rounded athlete who could be able to do anything you wanted to. Did you play football, soccer, you know, baseball, track?
I dabbled very little in anything. I remember being in track for a little bit, and mostly I was just jumping on the pole vaulting mats, you know, goofing around, getting in trouble. And I remember joining baseball and shit when I was real young, like the other kids. But, you know,
because that was a thing to do.
Everyone did, yeah. You know, T-ball. I remember striking out with T-ball. I couldn't hit the damn ball. So I never saw myself, and no one – else either saw me as being a great athlete. And it was like something where through being a wrestling fan, once I knew that I wanted to be a wrestler and I wanted to make that happen, I joined high school wrestling and I quit for the same reason, because I wanted to be a pro wrestler. I was 165 pounds and the coach is telling me that he thought I could drop down to like 137. I'm like, what? Dude, I want to weigh 237. I was eating everything I could trying to be big. So I started getting into martial arts outside of the school after that. I actually didn't know that that athletics was a special niche or something that I was seen as being good at until it was like 97. Taz did an interview one time and they asked him who he thought the most athletically gifted wrestler in the business was, and he had said me.
Yeah.
And that was the first I'd heard of that. Like, it was like a virgin thought, like, really? But I mean, what about,
so,
like, I mean,
as news to you that you're a good athlete?
Yeah, I mean, I knew, yeah, in a comparative scale, yes, because I was a good athlete. I knew I was, but to be considered one of the best, looking at the scale of the wrestlers, I was like, yeah, but what about like Rey Mysterio and these guys? I mean, if you're talking about just, you know, moves and shit, and usually people to that would say, yeah, but you know, for your size, you know, Rey so little, and whatever it is, that inspired me to start. You know what? I'm gonna start outdoing my moves every week. So I used to run and jump over the top rope and not touch it and do a flip and land on my opponent before other guys were doing that. Then I put a chair there and I would run, jump over the chair and the rope. Next time I'm in Philly, two chairs. And that was the elevation.
I mean, you were talking that's about what that ECW was. You were was. Talking about progression of how you would do
that's
that.
That's how
you
ECW
would start
was.
Off doing that. You built up to it. But then let's go back to your wrestling school days. So how do you join up? Because for a shoot, you're a Battle Creek, Michigan guy, right?
Yes.
Okay, you're an L.A. guy.
Yeah.
So have you lived in just both of those places, or were there places in between?
No, I traveled once I was in the business.
Okay, but how did you find the Sheik to train you?
Okay, so when I was a senior and I was really looking into, okay, I'm going to get into this career right out. I'm not going to waste time, you know, boom, as soon as I can. I did a lot of research. It was a magazine, Pro Wrestling Illustrated or something, that had send $5 and we'll send you a list of all these wrestling schools, you know, and I did that. And I was corresponding. I wrote or called all over the country, talked to the Monster Factory, Larry Sharp. I could hear people taking body slams in the background. I was so excited. Like, wow, that's... And talked to Johnny Hunter in North Carolina. He told me that marriage and business don't work well together.
He was right.
Right? And anyway, I thought that I was going to go to Killer Kowalski school. Like that was what was going to work out for me. And it was, you know, the tuition was important, the credibility, who they had trained, how long they'd been there. And
I
was
a lot of thought into this.
Yeah, I mean, I was a smart kid. I mean, you'd be surprised only knowing my wrestling character. But my gift before being athletics actually was an academic gift. And it's like something that I'm tapping back into now after dumbing myself down
did
for wrestling.
Did you excel in high school from the scholastic
standpoint? No, in earlier years I did, although I did have a scholarship to go to Michigan State that I did not, that I went to wrestling school instead. Right. So I was bagging groceries, doing all these odd jobs, saving money to go to wrestling school to see Killer Kowalski, and this big dude comes through and I started saying, man, if I had your size, I'd make it so much money, man. I'm going to be a pro wrestler. I started talking to him. He introduced me to the Sheik, and that was December of 89. The year I graduated high school.
Okay, you graduated from high school in 89. Then you go directly to start working with the Sheik.
Yeah.
Okay, so what did he charge you? I mean, or what did lessons cost? Because when I went to Chris Adams Wrestling School, it was $1,500. I never paid it all off because we were working the loop, and that's how I got a lot of my push from just working an angle with him out of the jump street.
Sure.
I really didn't deserve to have, but that's how much I was supposed to pay. I probably paid $1,200.
Yeah.
So going rate for the Sheik was what?
I think it was $2,000, if I remember. You know, I had to try out. It wasn't just like, hey, you know.
Oh, so you're a piece of shit. You're not going to get in.
Totally, totally. Yeah. And I was the only one there. It wasn't like a class. I showed up the first time I met Sheik, first time I met Sabu. He's in the ring with me. And the ring is cut in half so they can fit it into this garage. And it's winter in Michigan, very cold, you know, so it's, and it's 8x16, this ring with the ropes.
Yeah. I've never heard of a rectangular ring. This is awesome.
8x16. Yeah. And I'm just, you know, I mean, I didn't know what to expect. I just knew I was going to make it. I was going to be a wrestler no matter what. Didn't know how successful I was going to be, but I was going to put a year or two into it. Anyway, she had Sabu get in the ring and just like pushing me around and stuff and check my balance and coordination. I didn't even know what they were doing, pulling, pushing around. And then he asked me to do, you know, he says, what do you do? I said, I can do flips and kicks. He goes, show me. So I'm like, oh, okay. So I'm in there by myself doing a kick, a split, you know. I go, okay, what else? Oh, okay, backflip, what else? You know, I ran out of shit eventually, and that's when he put Sabu in there. And then he says, okay, good job. He goes, come back next week, bring me some money. And I was like, sweet, I made it. I think it was $2,000. I signed a contract, and same thing. I mean, you know, when he would work me, it would come off of the deal, and I doubt that I ever paid him the full deal. But it was like there was a time attached to it so that, you know, if someone wanted to book me, they would have to go through him. Like, he owned me for that time, and I'm
And like, you know, a 10% or 20% commission or something?
Maybe something.
Okay, but here's this. When I signed up for Chris Adams Wrestling School, man, it was once a week, Saturday, after they did the television taping at the Sportatorium in Dallas, Texas. There was a live show Friday night, and then Saturday morning they did TV live to tape, played that night. Then we'd go, we'd have probably 2 hours. Well, when I joined the wrestling school, there was 25 other kids in there, and no one made it. And I was glad I made it. But my point is, with one ring, with 25 cats, we first started learning flat back bumps, rolling, tumbling, basics. Chris was good about that. And then just fundamentals about, you know, grabbing an arm, just a cunt hair of chain wrestling. And then boom, you know, I was basically in the ring with way before I really needed to be in the ring. But I've seen the Sheik work. The Sheik was a heat-seeking missile and a fucking legend, especially up in the Detroit area. Yeah. But he drew money wherever he went. With his style being what it was, now with Sabu already in the mix, now I can see maybe where you got some of the rolling tumbling stuff from, because you didn't get that from Sheik. How did you come up with your style versus what the Sheik was teaching you? Your time with him, your time with Sabu.
Yeah.
What defined your style?
So I had my flips. I had my kicks. I taught Sabu to do some flips, actually, and he taught me how to do like some arm drags, right? I was already a show off, and I was already even extreme, because like I grew up every summer we'd go to this campground that had a swimming pool, and I'd show off on the diving board. If everyone else was doing a flip and a half, I would have to do two flips. Everyone was doing a backflip, I'd have to learn how to do a backflip and a half, and I was already extreme. When I was a kid, I would walk on the diving board, drop down into a split, bounce off of my hamstrings up into a handstand, walk to the end of the board, and then do a flip from there. And that was, nobody was paying
to
see
that.
Dude,
that's straight up showing off.
That's all it was about. Yeah, you know, there was some girls around the pool, and, you know, those were the perks. Nobody was paying for it. But so what the Sheik taught me was you couldn't not believe in the business with the Sheik. Nowadays, a lot of times people teach safety first. No, I got taught you protect the business first. And I swear 100%, he never smartened us up on anything. If you were completely oblivious to the fact that you're working with each other, you could go through his whole school and never even know that any of it was a work. Because he never said, here's the right way to land. He never said, here's the right way to grab a guy without hurt. He wanted us to kill each other. And it was all about grab him, headlock him, take him down, squeeze him. And we could not be stiff enough. It was all, he didn't want to see kicks and stuff like that. He wanted to see reversals, go behinds. And anytime you're down, if I don't jump on you to try to beat you, to try to pin you, then I don't understand what the fuck I'm doing in the ring.
Yeah, because you're trying to win.
Yeah, that's the way we got taught. Like, I'd put you in a headlock, and he'd say, what, are you afraid you're gonna hurt him? Grab him. And I'd squeeze it, and he'd say, you look like a couple of fucking cunts up there. And the last thing we wanted was for him to come up into the ring, and because he'd beat the shit out of us, he'd choke us, he'd bite my nose, you know, and it'd be scary because he'd big ol' eyes, and it would fire us up. That's
was
the way
he
I learned.
Scary in person?
Yeah, absolutely. I remember one time, this was probably, it was one of my first four shows. I don't know, it was in Vermont, and myself and one of the other guys, like, we wanted to look in and see what was in his briefcase, and that, you know, he kayfabe does totally about everything, you know. I was lucky I got to hear him speak English. No one else did, but we were like, dude, look in his briefcase, what do you think's in there? And he was like getting dressed or whatever, and we were like behind his shoulder, and we just like slowly like he leaned around over his shoulder, and we tried to take a peek, and he saw us, he slammed up, what the fuck are you looking at? We took off running.
Yeah.
He was scary. He was intimidating. And he made us believe in him. He made us believe in the business. And it was all about protecting the business. That's why it's so hard for me right now to adjust. Not that I'm really trying to, but even to accept the way that it's changed. And I know, I understand evolution. I was a big part of it. You know, I take responsibility for being a trailblazer, a pioneer in a style that changed. And I know the old timers didn't want that back then. Like Stan Hansen was so bitter when I was in All Japan because the stuff I was doing backflips off the guardrail. No one else was doing that there. And Stan was always like putting me down with that. He called me Claude, and he'd say, yeah,
we've been, and he could get away with it.
Yeah. Anything. Yeah. But he would be like, well, he'd say, let Claude go in there and do all his bullshit and then tag me and I'll try to make it real again. And that's how he always treated me. Yeah. Until I was in the ring with him one time, though. One time I was in the ring with him and he's in the corner. I gave him a few shoulder blocks. Boom. I did a backflip and I ran at him and kicked him in the face. And, you know, he's blind. And afterwards he goes, I got to admit, you know, I always thought all your shit was bullshit. But being there, he said, you were like you were there 1 second and then you just disappeared. I couldn't find you. And I actually earned his respect like that.
Well, yeah, by kicking the fuck out of his face, too. Yeah. I mean, Stan was stiff.
Yeah, no doubt. But I know back then that he was really bitter about the way it was changed because he would, you know, he'd be backstage saying, well, but then again, what the hell do I know, you know, and I'm out of this anyway, so it doesn't matter. I don't want to be that guy. You know what I mean? I don't.
So what was your going into your first match? Because going back to your point about Sheik not smarting anybody up, Chris Adams didn't smarten us about nothing. All of a sudden, he decides it's time for me to have my first match. I'm a wrestling guy from Louisiana named Frogman LeBlanc. He was just kind of like a journeyman kind of guy, jobber, enhancement guy, with due respect to Frogman. But all of a sudden, we go up into this office. It's just Chris Adams, me, and Frogman. He goes, okay, Steve, you know, you're going to go about, you know, 8 or 10 minutes, and you'll win with the flying clothesline. And I'm thinking, first of all, I don't do a flying clothesline. Second of all, now you're telling me all this shit? There's a bunch of people, probably 3,000 people down there in TV taping, and it's going to be a televised match coming on that night. And I didn't know it was to work. So all of a sudden, I got Frogman out there, and I'm deaf, Rob. Not a lot of people don't understand it. I started calling matches.
What?
That's
why you do that.
But I started calling matches at an early age because I don't, you know, in my career, because I don't hear so well. And so I got away with doing that with, you know, 95% of the people I worked with. So all of a sudden, Frogman's trying to call spots. I'm out there. Ain't nobody ever called a high spot for me. So if you ain't ever run a high spot and all of a sudden you're trying to learn one on TV, tackle drop down hip toss is about as basic as you can get. Would you agree?
Yeah.
Okay, well, on TV, when someone says tackle, drop down, hip toss, get it again, what the fuck is that?
Yeah.
So we stunk the joint out. There we go. What was your first match experience like?
Well, so like we worked with each other. I had my best friend. His name was Dango. He and I were both kickboxers, so like the first match we worked against each other, and it was like a work kickboxing match where we ended up you know, getting pissed, tearing the gloves off, going at it, and a big pull apart. So they protected us like that. And that's the way that you know, the first couple matches were like that, and I slowly got in. But I also want to say, back then, like the first time I was in the dressing room one time before I had a match, at least one time, and I was so proud to be with the Sheik's entourage. It was, and I haven't even said this, but the entourage was so small. The school, there was Sheik, who would be, and then myself and Sabu, my friend I just mentioned, Dango, and there was two other guys, and that was it. There was 1, 2, 3, 4, so there was 5 of us, and that was it. Anyone else that showed up, they would never come back, ever, because they were training a different way, and we were beating the shit out of each other. So that's all there ever was. But the first time it was at Euclid, Ohio, a town in Cleveland, and the Sheik was wrestling there. Jerry Lawler was there. I don't know if Sheik wrestled Jerry Lawler, possibly. I think he did. But anyway, I was so prepped by Sheik and Sabu. When you're in the dressing room, you're not a fan. You're one of the boys, you know. Do not, you know, don't go up to anybody, you know, and ask for an autograph or a picture. Don't, you know, don't even talk to anybody unless you just want to introduce yourself and shake their hand and say your name, and then that's it. And he was like, otherwise, just stand there and you know, don't talk to anybody. And I was like, oh, okay, cool. And I was taught that. So it was very early into my career that the part of being like a fan was kind of it kind of subsided, you know, because I was taught that way. So it wasn't so many years down, it did become just business, because I was taught early, you know, to, you know, you're just like them. These are just guys, you know. So anyway, point is, now someone gets the tattoo on the back of their neck from when they won the championship belt, or they the things are like so different, or they take a picture with the belt on their shoulder stroking their heart on, you know. And it's like, back in the day, those guys, I mean, people like that would not have been accepted, right?
Right.
That's where I came in, like that kind of way.
Okay, so let's talk about the point in your career that you really started to feel like pro wrestling was going to work out for you, that you were good at it. And we'll do that after we talk about another successful pro wrestler who also happens to be the very successful owner and creator of DDP Yoga, my close personal friend, Diamond Dallas Page. Y'all know that DDP has changed thousands of lives, including the lives of some of your favorite pro wrestlers like Jake the Snake, Scott Hall, Mick Foley, AJ Styles, and of course, Chris Jericho, Y2J. And DDP Yoga can change your life too. And believe me when I say, Dallas has made it real easy for you to get on the program. His new DDP Yoga Now app means you can do DDP Yoga anytime, anywhere, and you can do it right from your phone or tablet. And the app has a lot more than just workouts on it. By connecting to a Bluetooth heart rate monitor, you can track your calories and heart rate in real time. You can track your pain, measurements, and progress photos too, all for free in the app. And like I said, you've got tons of workouts to choose from. The original DDP Yoga workouts, the new 2.0 workouts, and weekly live workouts from the DDP Yoga Performance Center. And to make it even easier than he's already made it, for a limited time, you can get the DDP Yoga DVDs for 15% off, plus 3 months of full access to the DDP Yoga Now app. Just go to ddpyoga.com/Austin. That's ddpyoga.com/Austin to take advantage of this great deal. Commit now. Change your life now. Go to ddpyoga.com/Austin to get started. If you're looking to buy a new or used car, then you need to check out TrueCar.com and the TrueCar app. I bet you didn't know that you can use TrueCar to help you buy a used car, too. It ain't just for new car purchases. There are over 500,000 pre-owned vehicles available from TrueCar certified dealers nationwide, and there are over 11,000 TrueCar certified dealers. And TrueCar lets you get upfront pricing information on new and used vehicles and lets you see what other people paid for the car you want so that you feel confident you're getting a fair price. With TrueCar, via their TrueCar pricing curve, you see what other people paid for the car and you lock in your guaranteed savings. Then you can connect with a local certified dealer of your choosing. Take them your TrueCar guaranteed savings certificate and make your car buying experience quick and easy. Over 2 million cars have been sold to TrueCar users by the TrueCar Certified Dealer Network. And TrueCar users save an average of over $3,000 off MSRP. So when you're ready to buy a new or used car, visit TrueCar.com or download the TrueCar app to enjoy a better car buying experience. Some features not available in all states.
At what point in your career did you feel like, hey man, I'm starting to gravitate towards this. I'm picking it up. I feel like I'm pretty confident with what I can do with my skills in the ring from a mechanical level, and then taking it on further to a psychological level.
Well, I got told early on that I was good. And so I started really, you know, being able to believe in myself. It was in 91 when I was in USWA, Ron Slinker, the man who eventually gave me the name Rob Van Dam. He was there. His stepson was Dennis Knight, Tex Slasher. Yes. So he was there kind of, I guess, visiting him, and he worked the show too. Ron did, but he took to me, you know. I was just, I don't even know what they called me then, you know, but I had short blonde hair and trunks, and he just said, you know, he said, you know, you got a lot of talent, kid. And he said, I think you're going to be a world champion someday. He said, I might be wrong. I wasn't wrong about Ricky Steamboat. I wasn't wrong about Randy Savage. You know, I just think, and I was just like, wow, you know, my head blew up. And then he said he's starting a promotion in Florida. And then I was on the phone with him like every week. Are you ready? Are you ready? Are you ready? I went down there before he was ready and helped open up the Sportatorium. I was painting the bleachers, hanging the sign up, and everything up on the roof because I was so excited, you know. And anyway, Eddie Mansfield said the same thing to me when I was down there in Florida. So I started like feeling like wow, you know, maybe I can really make it to a level in this business. But as far as like putting it all together and really understanding the story and stuff, I feel like in order to really understand that, you have to be so well-rounded by being in all these different organizations.
Right.
When I watch the ECW matches now, I'm proud of the athleticism and the stories we told. It was relevant to that style. But when I look at, you know, some of the non-selling and then, you know, some of the moves that are the crippling moves that people that, you know, people are nipping out from, not that anyone would do that in WWE. Oh, the nip up? Oh, yeah. No, that works. Anyway, when I went to WWE, and then it was more about, you know, making each thing mean so much more and stretching it out. At least part of it was. Part of the adjustment was. Some of that shit you fight and you struggle with at first because you think, oh, they just can't keep up. But then after you accept it and then you learn to really appreciate it, then you look back at that, and then the other guys that don't have that yet, that think they're well-rounded,
right?
And it's frustrating. When I was with TNA, there was a lot of guys that really felt like they had it and they didn't need to get better. You know, they were fine with where they were at in their career and they were in whatever. And then working with them was a little frustrating because there was a lot of times when they would want to do something and I would just be and they would actually like put up a I don't want to say an argument or a debate, but like when I'd say, well, they'd say, when we're going over, they'd say, dude, I think, you know, like this move should be, I'd be like, well, gee, why don't we see what the agent thinks? You know, and 100% of the time, D'Lo Brown would come over and be like, "Listen, yeah, no, Rob's right," because and then he'd have to explain it. And after a while, I was just like, you know what? I'm going to be in my car. Just let me know when it's match time. Just want to go out there and show off. And I didn't enjoy that part of it, you know, dealing with people that I feel, I don't want to say it's a lack of respect, but I'm more comfortable with how far I've come and where I'm at and appreciating that than some of them seem to be.
Hey, you mentioned two names before you went on that little tirade there or explanation, that rant. You brought up two badass names, Ricky Steamboat and Randy Savage, yeah. Two of the greatest of all times. You happened to be there at WrestleMania 3.
Yes.
Right there in Detroit, right?
Yeah.
So how was that for you? Did you know at that point that those guys knocked it out of the ballpark, that the bases were loaded and they hit a grand slam? I mean, that was just a spectacular match. Had fucking George Animal Steel and Elizabeth out there. That the bell, the whole scene. What were your thoughts on that match? Because if you ask a lot of the boys in the business, probably – in our generation, I'm probably a half generation ahead of you, that would be a lot of guys' favorite match of all time.
Yeah.
Did that make an impression on you?
Totally. I mean, I might have been, I don't know, 14 or whatever, but I knew that, if I remember right, I remember thinking that that was the best technical match that I'd seen at that time. You know, the only thing to put against that is that I was still such a fan that I was still, you know, waiting to see my favorites come out. So I even had a sign or a couple signs. I was such a mark at that point. So, you know, sometimes your judgment is based more on, you know, some of that.
Okay, well, where you were at back then, were you waiting on Hogan Andre? Because wasn't that the main event?
It totally was the main event. And
because that was bigger than life era.
It really was.
These guys were in the ISC department. And, man, that belt was given to some of the most premier workers in the business. And many times was figured even hotter than a world title.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, I was looking forward to the world championship match. And I usually, at that time, you know, I love Hulk. But there was a time, you know, when I always would root for the heel that was going up against him. Yeah. Hercules Hernandez. Oh, he's going to beat. No, he beat him. Yeah. You know, Bobby. And said that Hogan shook out when Hercules had him in his torture. Yeah. He did. I was rewinding it, showing my friends my VHS. Look, his head goes up and down there. He's giving up. But, you know, I was looking forward to that match, but it wasn't like the favorite match that I was looking forward to of the night by any means.
I always thought Hercules Hernandez has been just so underrated throughout his career. He's a big guy, great physique.
I loved him.
I had a few conversations with him. I traveled a couple of loops with him. Nicest guy in the world, jacked up. Worked the power, you know, routine because he was a big guy. And I thought it was great. You come out there with the big chain, use the chain. But he gets overlooked a lot these days. But he was an impressive guy. He had a good run in his own right.
Yeah, well, people, you know, like back to values, you know. As I said, I'm always trying to become a better person. So there's something that I believe, and I'll ask you because there's exceptions to everything, but I'd like to get your opinion on this. I think that the source of every conflict is mismatched values. And I think that the more I study, you know, becoming a better person and my Zen principles that I apply to my life, I feel like the more accepting people are that you have your own values, I have my own values. If everyone just knew that, then there'd be like so much less conflict and struggle for energy. Because, you know, when you're a kid, you're like, dude, why you wear those shoes?
Yeah.
Dude, why are you hanging out with that guy?
Yeah.
But that is the answer to that, because these are my values. You know, yeah. What a stupid argument it would be to be like, dude, why is your favorite color purple? That shouldn't be your favorite. Dude, if someone likes purple, then fuck it. And I think that kids and adults, even wars, like everything is about, you know, mismatched values and people just not accepting that. Like me, I accept that, and it helps keep me even keel just knowing that, oh yeah, hey, that dude, he is dressed funny or whatever, but so what?
Like, that's his gig.
Yeah, whatever. I don't care. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, back in my days, probably, you know, in my early 20s, yeah, I was probably that guy. You know, I was the former football player. You know, I wasn't good enough to play pro ball, but I was good enough to get some scholarships, get a free education out of it. I thought I was pretty badass. You know, started getting, you know, hitting the weights, really trying to get into the pro wrestling business and, you know, start hearing about Shawn Michaels. Ah, shit, I seen him, you know, because you're very competitive. You know, if you ever watch NBA, those players, when they give each other props, it's just barely props because it's so competitive.
Right.
So you look at Shawn Michaels, I'm a high spot guy.
Right.
Well, then when you work with Shawn, and all of a sudden that's when your eyes kind of go wide open. You're like, no, this motherfucker can really go.
Yeah.
But, yeah, there comes a time where, you know, when you think of the coolest thing on earth or whatever, or as a kid you're a little ignorant or you're not at a high enough experience level to understand why people think what they think and how or what chose them to come to this part in their life. I love talking to people. There's a guy I go out and visit in the desert every now and then. His name is Chuck. Chuck's 95 years old. He was in the Battle of the Bulge over in Normandy, France,
wow.
World War II. When I go out there and talk to him and get the chance to just hear stories about what he did. I mean, he didn't tell me anything about the war because he doesn't like talking about it. But when you just talk to someone that's older than you or been down through a bunch more shit than you, but just has more life experience, and you gain from that because you get a chance to center a learning tree. It's kind of like some of the veterans that either took you under their wing or me, and you learn from those guys. Just people in general, hanging out with or being able to communicate with older people. They always say respect your elders.
Sure.
Hey, I believe in that.
Me too.
Because they've been around the horn, they got more experience, they've been here longer than you, and they probably know much more than you. And I look back now at 51, if I'd have been as, I'm not talking about book smart, I'm not a genius, but if I know then what I know now, God damn. You know, I had a pretty good run. I could have fucking probably magnified it times two or three if I'd been a bit smarter with myself.
Yeah, and I don't really have too many regrets. You know, when I look at things, I could have done this, could have done that, but the reason I didn't is because doing this was more important to me at the time, and that's where I'm at now. When I mentioned the values, the reason that I brought that up, just so you know that it's relevant, for me growing up, my favorite wrestler was someone that I don't think anyone has ever told him that he was their favorite, Leaping Lanny Poffo. Like, he totally lost every match, but as a fan, he caught my attention because he was doing, you know, flying head scissors and, you know, cartwheels, moonsault out of the corner, even though we didn't know it was called a moonsault yet. Nobody was doing that. And so for me, in the monkey flip, and I was just like, whoa, and I pulled for him. Like, man, this guy, this is his night. He's going to win tonight. You know, as a fan, I believed in that. And so to my values, you know, they're more about being different, you know, being exciting, catching attention rather than being like everyone else. And I've applied that to myself as well. I consider myself a nonconformist, and it's because I'm content meeting my own standards. I don't need to meet other people's standards.
Quick, two questions. Did Lanny Poffo inspire, because you said the monkey flip, the big monkey flip out of the corner that you used?
Well, I mean, he was one of the guys, sure, but I mean, you know.
Well, not a whole lot of people were really doing that way.
True.
A monkey flip, yes, but not in the fashion, you know, out of a turnbuckle with that kind of height or length.
Yeah, I can't say for sure, but my whole style was inspired by being a fan of his. And then Brady Boone, when he was that battle cat with a gimmick, a hood for a while. His first guy I see to jump up on someone's shoulders and do a victory roll. I was like, whoa, that's so cool. I got to try that on my friends. Yeah. Owen Hart, by the way, Blue Blazer. I love that. You know, seeing him drop down on the rope and bounce off his legs. I didn't know that was possible until I saw him do it. I didn't get any Mexican or Japanese wrestling when I was a kid, and I don't even know if they were doing that then anyway.
Okay, that being said, before I get to that other question, to backtrack, are you a Lucha Libre fan just by the dynamic movement and the combinations and sequences they put together? Or is it not hardcore enough?
It's I would say it's neither. Like I am impressed with the impressive moves, just like anybody else. It's what bothers me about it is that one guy smacks the guy on his ass and he takes off running into the ropes. I don't get that.
Right.
I don't understand that. And you know, there's so many weak slaps to the chest, and I don't get that either. I mean, the Sheik would have been like, "Where are you going?"
That's what I'm saying. I was going to say the Sheik would be
I take somebody and I throw them into the ropes, and sometimes you can't tell if they look like shit when they're throwing. I mean, that's something that comes with experience, but sometimes somebody will do something half-ass, and if you overreact to it, you know, then it makes everything look bad, and it's because this dumbass doesn't equal up to your efforts.
And it's an interesting note on throwing someone into the ropes, because when you throw so many ropes to deliver something, I throw everybody, whether it's corner to corner turnbuckle, you're throwing them with force and authority. But then on a technical level, going to the Lucha stuff, it's a kind of halfway send-in, because I think it's all a timing issue, and the guy's got to be under control not to be coming back too fast to do whatever combination they were going to do. We're done with that. I want to ask you about what you just said a while ago, and it's on your shirt. Nonconformist. It says nonconformity on the shirt. Explain to me the mindset of a nonconformist.
Okay. So, yeah, this is one of my T-shirts. I'm the Nonconformity Ninja. Nonconformity.ninja. You can buy these. But so this is the duck-billed platypus. This is nature's nonconformist. Man looked at the platypus.
The most misunderstood mammal in the world.
Yes. Yes. And man looked at the platypus and says, I don't know. You're a mammal, but then you lay eggs and you got these venomous claws, and you're a paradox. And the platypus said, dude, I'm just being myself. It's your systems that are fucked up. That's the way I see everything. Right. I'm just being myself. You know, if someone wants to tell me when I'm out there, dude, you know you can't wear white socks with black shoes, right? Like, are they really helping me? I ain't trying to be you, motherfucker. You know what I mean? It's not that, and I don't want to offend anybody. So, you know, I don't want to dress in a way that offends anybody. I'm not the best dresser. I'm not, you know, a material person in a lot of ways, but I have like my own standards, and I realize that they're much different than everyone else. So I look at a lot of people as followers, as sheep, and it's easier for them to be that.
Follow a trend.
Yeah. I don't think I'm necessarily a leader, but I'm definitely not a follower. And if people can grow from my experiences and what I share, I don't think that necessarily makes them a follower. But if they, you know, I want everyone to realize their own values, realize their own priorities. You know, take a look at what is most important to you in life. You know, and write a list of that and think about that. You might know yourself a lot more from doing that. Oh, well, no wonder I can't get around to, you know, to writing this or hanging out with this person. I'm too busy doing this because this is actually what I want to do. This makes me happier. I pay attention to my vibration. And the way that my vibration changes when I'm around other people with different vibrations, or when I'm around different environments, and I get to know myself better. So my goal is to try to always keep my spiritual vibration tuned at the highest frequency as possible. And what that means is avoiding stress. It means avoiding negativity. And a lot of people don't do that. A lot of people hate their job. They hate where they live. They hate their family. They hate what they drive. And they're used to that. I'm not. I'm not good with stress. If something bothers me, it's like a rock that's obstructing the flow of my chi. I look at the yin and yang like it's rotating, like it's a pond with a circular motion of flow, and then you got to take that rock out because it's obstructing that flow, and then boom, you can't take all the rocks out. That'd be perfection, and we're human, but you work towards it. I do.
And being a nonconformist, it's not like you're necessarily rebellious.
No,
it's not like you're going to say, "I'm going to wear a black and white checkered outfit because no one else does this, and I want to stand out. It's just you being you.
Yeah, I actually don't want to stand out. You know, I get enough attention right. all the time, so I try to, like, blend in. And it's about being yourself and just being content with that. And when you realize, like, holy crap, I'm wasting so much energy trying to make this person happy because they say, I like listening to country music or rap music, and then my friends say it's stupid. Fuck them. Do what you want to do.
Yeah. Speaking of music, what do you listen to?
I'm not very musically inclined, actually. I like I listen to more talk or I guess if I have music on, I listen to it for the vibe. But reggae, I listen to reggae because it reminds me of being in Jamaica, and that makes me happy. I listen to electronic dance music, usually because it reminds me of being in Vegas at the clubs, having a good time, and that brings a positive vibration out of me. And it's usually that I can't tell you Freebird. Like, I don't get that. That's also a thing of values. Like, how can you argue about who's better than someone else when entertainment is so subjective?
It's all subjective.
Yeah.
And you can go to the box office and see how many people like these people, but subjectively, I'll tell you right now, one of the biggest rock and roll bands of all time, The Who, and the Rolling Stones. I didn't really get them. I got a bunch of other shit, but, I mean, they're two of the best bands in the history of rock and roll based on box office. But so I guess going back to subjectivity.
Yeah.
You talk about vibrations a lot.
Yeah.
Each time you come upon somebody, do you feel their vibration? I mean, is something like being around? I know when I'm around a super negative person, but with all the Zen stuff that not all, you're talking about because I'm asking you to talk about it. With all the Zen stuff and the vibration stuff, you're not like a happy-go-lucky guy. Like, you're just happy motherfucker. But you just focus on being positive, and you seem like the glass is half full. I wouldn't go around just saying, yeah, he's energetic as fuck, he's up.
No, but people, mostly people do, the feedback I hear mostly when people encounter me, they say what a cool down to earth guy he is. I hear that I'm positive. A lot of people are inspired by my positive outlook. A lot of guys in the business that know me say the same thing. But yeah, I'm not one of those. I'm envious of those people that have so much energy that they can't sit still. I'm the opposite. Those people that, like, boom, they get stuff done. I have projects. Most of my projects take 10, 15 years because I just get to them when I can, and they're still important to me, but that's kind of more my pace. Yes, I feel everybody's energy. You exude a vibration, you know, whether you know it or not. It's in the tone of your voice. It's in the way that you carry yourself. And I don't just feel like your vibration, but I'm feeling mine interacting with yours, and that's more of an inner study because, you know, you that's how you find out, you know, I like this, but I don't like that. Think about it this way. You can't think good thoughts and feel bad at the same time. All right. Think about that. You can argue if you want, but also you can't think bad thoughts and feel good at the same time. You can't do it. They're directly linked. So as a person, you actually can choose what you think about, and you can consciously take yourself out of a bad mood if you, like, have a list. If you're like, oh, I'm so stressed. Right. Wait, let me think about what makes me happy. It could be anything. Oh, yeah, watching porn, you know, puts me in a good mood. Whatever it is, you know, if you have that to go to, you can control it. We like to sulk sometimes, and we feel like we own, like, punishing ourselves, or we try to fix something that can't be fixed. And that's, you know, that's something that I do a lot. I go back in time. I'm still trying to figure out how to keep my dog from dying in December, but I can't. There's nothing I can do about it.
Right.
So yeah, so if you think good thoughts, you feel good. You think bad thoughts, you feel bad.
What kind of vibe we got going on here?
It's a good vibe because, like, I feel very much like I don't have to adjust my vibe very much. You know, we started saying at the beginning of this, I was saying, you know, we don't know each other that well. I know your character.
Yeah.
Yeah. So your character and the energy that your character exudes has a it's called an energy manipulation, and you use one that's called intimidation. That's something when someone's really loud and they're forcing your focus on them, then that drains people of their energy. And let's take like...
But that was in an anti-authority type setting when I was being fucked. So that was the thing.
But, okay.
It wasn't always about me being loud or wanting the attention. It was about, hey, the system's fucking me. They're poking me with a stick.
But it's about Stone Cold being the boss.
Yeah.
It's about Stone Cold being the boss.
In character.
Right. And then, that's what we're talking about. And then it's saying, you know, hey, get over here, kid. You know, you need to do this. Go do this. You know, like in real life, that would be somebody that I would never want to be around.
Correct.
You know what I mean? And in fact, I like if someone is loud in the room and then it becomes like a struggle to see who can hold the conch.
Yeah.
I'm turned off from that. And normally I will, I'll be an introvert and I'll just, you know, if I'm in the room, I usually won't talk because I'll let them talk. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah.
Unless I really have a point to make, and that's, you know, that's in certain contexts.
But in coming up with all this, and watching some of your stuff, I know you're heavily intrigued by the mafia, and you were intrigued with the movie industry here in Hollywood. I mean, you researched all of that stuff.
Yeah.
You got books up to your ceiling about it. So then when you talk about the energy fields or vibration and all the Zen stuff, how much did you research that? Because I know you live it. So you know that from living it, but how did you research that?
So one of the first books that was a life changer for me, it's called The Celestine Prophecy. Have you heard of it? Okay. So everyone that I meet that has read the book has a similar life-changing story. Like, oh my God, yeah, it changed the way that I look at everything. And that's when I started seeing everything as energy. And that was like when I quit. When I left WWE back in 2007, like I finished my contract and I chose not to resign. They wanted me to resign, but I was really, I needed to work on my spiritual health. I was so burnt out and I was tired of being just the guy that says cool or whatever, but at the same time I didn't want to say, you know this paper means more than, you know, my family to me, you know, fuck that. But anyway, I needed to get away. I didn't know how long I needed to get away, but it was real important for me to discover the other parts inside of me. You know, I started doing this RVD TV and I did RVD radio. I don't even know if any other wrestlers were doing like podcasts back then. I don't know, it was something important to me, and I would discuss thought-provoking topics, you know, whether it was something people wouldn't talk about, could be, you know, marijuana legalization, could be abortion, it could be God, whatever. I was, you know, just, hey, let's just see what we can get out of this kind of, I enjoyed that so much, and I grew so much from that. The book Celestine Prophecy is it's a fictional book, but it deals with non-fictional elements to those of us who are inclined to be spiritual. So it's about a guy that goes to Peru in search of a manuscript that has 9 insights towards spiritual ascension. But when you read it, people like us, like me, they can relate to every single insight, you know, like, that's me, oh my God. And anyway, that was a life changer for me. It changed like how I interact with people. I try not to take their energy, you know, so that it's even. I try not to give my energy unwittingly. And then, you know, I enjoyed The Secret. Most recently, something I would recommend, it's called The 4 Agreements. The 4 Agreements is a quick, easy read, and I love it. That's the most recent spiritual book. And basically the concept of the 4 Agreements is when you were born into this world and you were an unaffected spirit, that was like the true you. But then right away, the true you gets polluted with the worldviews. So people say, this is the way it is. You know, you're going to go to school. You're going to get a good job. Okay. Jesus is right here in the room with us. And you're going to, you know, do this. You're going to get married. You're going to have kids. Whatever everyone tells you, you learn to accept that as fact as a kid. Like, you hear it so much. You might rebel against some of it. And then adults win because they're stronger and you accept it as fact. So with the 4 agreements, you take this point in life and you try to reprogram yourself so that you can try to find that true spirit that that originally was supposed to be here. And so there's just like 4 things that you apply to life.
When did you read the 4 programs? What's
the 4 agreements.
The 4 agreements. Did you go through the process? Yes.
Yeah. Oh no. Every day, I use it every single day. I use it every single day. It's just easy stuff, but I mean, it goes with explanation, you know. But it's just like you just go like in agreement one. Don't assume. And then I realized all day and all week how much people are assuming, and I try to get better at that. You know, like, well, obviously he's not here, so he must think, well, you don't know that. You don't know that. You know, and that like alone like changes life so much. And sometimes you have to, you know, kind of guess something with the information you have, but if you really make an attempt to not assume. And then another one is be as good as you can with your word. Like, your word is so important.
Right.
When you use your word. And when you tell somebody something, think about it. You could make someone or break someone just by the littlest comments. And so be conscious of that, you know, when you're saying something, that the strength that your words have. And one of them is always do your best, which is great. And then I can't remember what the other one is. I'll blurt it out while we're talking about the next thing.
Well, it's interesting that someone would say do your best in a book, but that's when you've been taught.
So you get these three
your whole life, but many people that gets lost in life sometime about
for
doing
sure.
your best, just doing enough to get by.
For sure. But I also relate it as like that's the fourth agreement in this, so I relate it mostly as do your best at applying the other three agreements.
Gotcha.
And then you're all set.
Hey, man, talk to me about The Secret for just a second. Someone gave me that book a couple years ago. I don't read very good, Rob. And then got ADD, and shit, I just don't like to read. If I'm going to talk to someone, I'll read their book, whatever I got to do. Nonetheless, The Secret. Bottom line it for me.
What was
The Secret?
Okay, so basically your vibration that you put out into the universe, which is based on your thoughts, which is based on some effort of trying to be positive and trying to be grateful, you know, grateful, so thankful for life, count your blessings, you know, and try and always be in the attitude of gratitude. And that vibration that you put out into the universe brings back into your life things of a similar quality. Likewise, if you put bad out there, bad will come back to you.
Okay, and with that being said, do you think also birds of a feather flock together? I mean, like, or... Maybe that's the wrong way to put this. If you, Rob, you're a good person, if all of a sudden you were hanging around with a bunch of degenerates, is that going to change who and what you are?
Instantly. Just with the vibration I'm talking about. When I leave here, if someone comes up to me, both of our vibrations change to meet each other. And so I instantly gravitate towards people that have a vibration more similar to mine. And I tend to want to be around those people more than people that my vibration has to adjust for so much, because that can be frustrating. And that's how I keep spiritually balanced. Is a conscious effort to do that. If I'm around somebody and because a lot of times people are stressing you out and you don't even know about it. Like, in the back of your mind, you're just like, I don't know why I'm in a bad mood. It's because this asshole right here, because you're adjusting, you know, just to exist, coexist. Get the fuck out of there. Get away from him.
How long did it take you before you started applying these theories to your life? I mean, because coming up a kid, I'm just guessing, in Battle Creek, Michigan, you're doing your high school, your show off, martial arts. When did you, I mean, like, how were you? I mean, were you a little, like, out there? I know you're highly intelligent, or are, but you hadn't picked up a Zen stuff yet. So where were you on the maturation process when you started applying this to your life?
Right. Well, I mean, it's all been like a progression. And like I say,
starting with martial arts?
Yeah. So martial arts, when I was a teenager, that's the first time that I started meditating. And the first time I remember somebody explaining their perspective and their version of how they meditated, he was a karate instructor. And he was telling us to imagine, you know, our eyes are closed, we're in the meditative position, and he's talking us through it, and he's telling us to see ourselves like from a bird's eye view. And so I was trying to imagine that, me sitting there in the class, there's, you know, what, I don't know, how, 10 people there, whatever. And then he kept zooming out. Now imagine yourself, you know, in this block. Imagine you, you know, just with this block. And then imagine you with the city of Battle Creek. And you got, you know, you're looking at yourself from the unit, from the space, and you're like, how insignificant are my problems that I'm stressing over, that my homework is due Friday and I didn't read anything, or that this girl, you know, isn't hitting me back, or whatever. Like, your problems, when you look at yourself as just being a drop in an ocean of all these spirits, then it really changes your perspective. And that's the first time I remember seeing it like that. You know, it's not just all Rob's world and everyone else is a character in it. I mean, it is from my perspective, you know, but when you change that perspective and you look at it, you know, like, dude, life is here, boom, and then it's so life is here, and it's so short. You and I have seen so many of our friends pass away, and it's like, knock on wood, hey, we're still here. You know, hopefully in several years, hopefully we'll be able to still say that. Who knows statistically, but the thing is, you know, to look at all of that and realize that that does happen. Make the most out of your life. You know, while you're here, if you want to do it, go for it. You're not going to be able to think about it later, or if you do, and you're in heaven looking back at it saying, oh, I should have done this or that. What fun would that be anyway? and that's all another subject, you know, talking about afterlife. But right. I'm just saying, you know, like, you're here for so long, you know, even if we live to be like on the high side of average, we're like halfway done. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, I got more years behind me than I do in front of
me.
We've
been adults longer than we were kids.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, do you meditate on a daily basis now?
No, but I wish I did.
Why don't you?
Because as an adult, I almost never can find a moment where time isn't a factor. And as a kid, time just lasts forever. Like summer vacation was like 5 years, you know what I mean? And so for me to meditate, I have to know that I don't just have 5 minutes or 10 minutes to sit here and do it, because for me, there's a goal to meditating. And it was a different guy that taught me how to meditate the way that I do now. And it has to do with trying to achieve a feeling of almost nothingness. I can describe it only as like floating or falling, and it is an out-of-body kind of feeling. In order to get there, I have to go through a lot of pointing out every distraction. So you get in the position, and I think about everything I can hear. Well, there's birds over there. There's a dog barking. There's a phone ringing. You know, I hear cars, and you go through all that, and you think about, okay, what can I feel? Well, the air is blowing on me on this side.
Yeah.
You go through all the senses, you know, I can, you know, what do I smell? You know, maybe you smell, maybe you, you feel the heat, you can feel the clothes. So I'll be like, I can feel where the shorts end on my leg, and then my bare leg begins, same thing with my shirt. I try and do all that, everything external. And then I go internal, and I think about my heart beating. I think about my breathing. I think about, you know, where the tension is. And you can always, let me sit up straight. There's tension in my back. And then I go back and forth from pointing out everything externally and internally until I feel like I can remove every single distraction. And even when you're there, then like a lyric to a song pops in, or a word or whatever. So it really takes an indefinite amount of time to where I can pull all that away and actually like float for a little bit. And the rewards are so good. Sometimes I actually do feel like one time I was doing that outside an arena, and some fans came up behind for a picture, and I was in that floating state of mind. And I actually tried to like get up and turn around, and kind of felt like I did, but I didn't. And that's what I go for. And I can't put a time on that.
So then how often do you need to meditate?
I love the word need.
Yeah.
The word need is so crucial, and it has to do with values. Again, you know, you see need different than I see need, different than anybody else. That's why it's so hard to communicate, because people can only see eyes.
But your need.
Well, I don't need to at all. I find it very beneficial and useful. I wish I meditated every day, and I meditate irregularly. You know, like sometimes it could be like, you know what, right now would be just a great time to go. I meditated yesterday in my sauna last night, and I was like, you know what, I'm just here doing nothing, sweating, you know, and it was it's irregular. I wish that I did it more. I find it beneficial in many ways. I feel better. My reflexes are always so much quicker afterwards, which is something that you may or may not expect. But you know that thing where you knock something off the table and you grab it in midair, you notice when you catch it, like, you know, 10 times as much right after you meditate than you can compare shit like that. And anyway, that's how you notice the difference. Besides just the clarity, the feeling healthier, you got physical, spiritual, and mental. You got to keep all three in balance, right? Physical, I'm all right with where I'm at now. I got a maintenance. I keep in shape. And, you know, like for a lot of people, that's most important. They're trying to get the newest work. But okay, cool. I'm trying to grow spiritually. And that's where the focus is. And also, of course, mentally, I'm stimulated by doing things outside of wrestling, because I had to dumb myself down so much to be able to wrestle and be okay with what's going on in there.
Okay, well, I want to get into more of your meditation practices and also want to jump back into wrestling, but they're giving me the go-home cue, so we'll have to get that all on next Thursday's show. So part two of my conversation with Rob Van Dam is coming up next Thursday on Unleashed. Right now, it's time for my video of the week. My video of the week is the man himself, the whole effing show, Rob Van Dam versus Jerry Lynn, Hardcore Heaven on YouTube. It's about a 15-minute match. All the bells and whistles, everything but the kitchen sink. Very physical match, lots of cool stuff, and lots of badass shit from both guys. A great match. Check it out on YouTube. Rob Van Dam versus Jerry Lynn, Hardcore Heaven. All right, now, ProWrestlingTees.com/Steve Austin is about to have a bunch of new T-shirts from yours truly. All the ones I wore on the new season of Broken Skull Challenge. And the best damn IPA on the planet is Broken Skull IPA at El Segundo Brewing Company here in Cali. And you can get it at Whole Foods and Total Wines if you live up in this neck of the woods. If you don't, check out InsideTheCellar.com or BrokenSkullRanch.com to see if they ship to your state. And I appreciate all you guys supporting the sponsors of the Steve Austin Podcast because they're the ones who let me do this for you free twice a week. So big thanks to DDPYoga.com. Go to DDPYoga.com/Austin to get 15% off the DDP Yoga program and 3 months of full access to the DDP Yoga Now app. To DraftKings, go to DraftKings.com and use the promo code UNLEASHED to play for free with your first deposit this weekend. To Loot Crate, go to LootCrate.com/Unleashed to save $3 off any new subscription. To TrueCar and Uber. And, of course, to Amazon, who have been supporting this podcast since day one. And Amazon is the best place to get the Broken Skull Cold Steel Pocket Knife. Just $75 for the most badass pocket knife on the planet from myself and Cold Steel Knives. And if you order the Broken Skull Cold Steel Knife through my Amazon links, Amazon will kick back a couple of bucks to the podcast. It won't cost you anything extra. There's no hidden fees or charges. You can buy whatever you just plan on buying and help out the podcast in the process. And you can find my Amazon links by going to podcast1.com, clicking on the Killer Deals button in the top right corner of the page, and then hitting the Steve Austin Show button. I've got Amazon links for Amazon USA, UK, and Canada. So again, go to podcast1.com. Click the Killer Deals button in the top right corner, then click on the Steve Austin Show. You'll find all my badass sponsors, all my Amazon links, all that stuff. You ain't got to buy nothing special. There ain't no extra charges or hidden fees. Buy whatever you plan on buying, and Amazon will kick back a small percentage to the show to help cover production costs. Bookmark the goddamn thing so you can find it easier. Hey, keep listening. The 60-second AP News headlines are coming up next. Until next time, folks. My name is Steve Austin, and I will catch your ass down the road.
Download new episodes of Steve Austin Unleashed every Thursday at podcast1.com. That's podcastone.com.